From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Andrew the Triforce Howard. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It's that time again. Friends and neighbors, fellow conspiracy realists, we are exploring one of the largest subjects in all of U.S. conspiracy lore, the Central Intelligence Agency, or the CIA. And let's be honest, guys, they get a lot of guff.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine what kind of issues people might have with the Central Intelligence Agency or CIA.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how much they employ trickery, right? That idea of the CIA being so deceptive, which is at the heart of this episode.
That's right, yeah. Which may end up being a two-part episode, a series, because we're diving into some deep water. Historically, it is true. The agency, as it's sometimes called, this organization is met with a great deal of controversy over the decades. But tonight, we're exploring a story many people may have missed. It's a bizarre and very true conspiracy. I don't know, catch up on our episodes on MK Ultra, catch up on the numerous times we roast the CIA a little bit for their weird cartoonish Acme level plans to kill Castro. And then after you do that, come back here. Exploding cigar, piping in LSD to a studio. It's wild. Let's pause for a word from our sponsors, and then maybe we begin by learning more about the history, the fact and fiction surrounding Uncle Sam's most powerful known intelligence agency. And there's a lot of fact and fiction there.
Who do you know on Ozempic or Semaglutide right now? Probably a ton of people. I know quite a few people as well, because it's everywhere and for good reason.
These groundbreaking GLP-1 medications are changing the weight loss game.
At Future Health, they make accessing this medication simple, safe, and affordable.
Their program connects you with licensed doctors who specialize in GLP-1 treatments, including Ozempic and Semaglutide, so you can get the support you need to reach your weight loss goals.
With Future Health, you'll have access to these trusted weight loss meds, plus ongoing care through their network of over 6,000 doctors and pharmacies nationwide.
And it's so easy to get started. Just go to tryfh.com.
That's tryfh.com.
Find out if weight loss meds are right for you in just 3 minutes at tryfh.com.
Future Health is not a healthcare services provider. Meds are prescribed at provider's discretion. Results may vary. Sponsored by Future Health. Here are the facts. All right, let's set the stage.
There's gonna be some fiction thrown in for good measure, right?
Oh, there has to be. Yeah, because a lot of the sources we're pulling are from the CIA itself. Yeah, maybe not an unbiased reporter, maybe a little bit of critics would call it an unreliable narrative, but that's what makes literature interesting. So where do we start? When we talk about the CIA, what's our ultimate genesis, like our Garden of Eden moment?
I guess I didn't realize comparatively, as far as other agencies are concerned, how relatively recently the CIA was created. The United States has always been super invested in gathering of intelligence, so much that the CIA's liaison conference center named three of its meeting rooms after Revolutionary War heroes, the idea of those early spy masters, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because you need to know what your enemy might be doing, and you also sometimes need to let your enemy think that you're going to do something, even when you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes, that's revolutionary times, times of the pharaohs, that's just go all the way back.
Master of Whispers and the like in the George R.R. Martin extended universe.
Love a reference. Yeah, that's Varys, right? And then also we could extend that reasoning further. Later, there's inevitable mission creep in any intelligence operation, and you start to apply the same things to people you call allies and friends, right? Let me also just trust but verify what my friend allies, my ally friends are saying.
Yeah,
friend and or foes.
But I think the difference here and why the CIA really stands out for history and for, you know, these types of organizations is because often that intelligence is dealing in war times, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're gathering intelligence to make war, and the CIA is really getting into almost prevention of war.
Well, think about the British is coming, you guys. I mean, first of all, they had to know that was happening. Then they had to have a clandestine way for Paul Revere to let people know, you know, to be prepared with the candles in the window and all of that, which is a banger Elton John song that was not apparently originally about Princess Diana.
And check out also our episodes on Agent 355, who has yet to be identified in the modern day, and the Culper Ring. If you go, like you were saying, Noah, to the Liaison Center, you'll see the CIA has, I don't want to, maybe not deify, but lionized a triumvirate of founding fathers that they consider emblematic and pioneers of three key aspects of intelligence. We've got, you know, now it's like a heist film, right? Where everybody gets their little hero moment at the camera. George Washington did a lot of stuff. he's also known as a pioneer in the acquisition of foreign intelligence. Key one. Turns out this guy was a crackerjack spy master, in addition to all this other stuff, including almost being king. But he did not do the cherry tree thing. That was
lore. Yeah, well, exactly. Myth or lore. Why is it that I'm picturing all of these guys like in like Street Fighter 2 style versus, you know, splash screens?
I like it.
We've got John Jay as well, in addition to George. He would later become Chief Justice. He was also considered the founding father of U.S. counterintelligence.
And then we've got Ringo. Oh, sorry.
My favorite. No. My favorite founding beetle.
Just joking. It is weird. This is George, John.
Benjamin. let's call him by his proper Christian name, Benjamin Franklin, who we know was you know, quite the Renaissance man, and I'm sure with his, you know, big brains, figured out some very clever ways of gathering intelligence and was a great collaborator in a lot of these schemes.
And a very naughty boy on multiple levels.
Yeah, but as we're going to learn throughout these episodes, and as the CIA learned, those types of activities where there's a lot of commingling going on, maybe a little activity, physical, mental. That's where a lot of intelligence can be both gathered and, you know, given to somebody else quietly. It's kind of creepy now that I really think about it. Why he was so good. That's why he was so good.
Well, not to mention flipping that the other way in sort of a honeypot operation, like a sting operation for entrapping, you know, foreign agents, you know, or gathering information clandestinely through a little naughty time.
Yeah, this guy, old Benji F. He probably didn't go by Benji.
Benny Franks to his friend.
I don't know why. I don't care for Benny. I don't know. Anyway, it's up to him. It's his name. Franklin.
Is it because of the Jets? Sorry.
Also a banger of Elton John song that in fact was
Are you
about
serious?
Benny and the Jets.
Yeah. Are you serious? Benny and the Jets. A banger?
That's right. I forgot.
We've had this conversation before.
I forgot you have issues. I think you might be taking it a little personally, Ben. You need to reevaluate it.
I'm too close. I got too close. Somebody exfiltrate me from the Elton John mission.
My dear friend Day, stained glass artist, she hates the song "It's a Beautiful Day" by U2 because she got teased with that all the time, and therefore she thinks she hates the band U2. And I've tried to show her like the Joshua Tree and turn her off from that way of thinking. Yeah. I understand, Ben.
Where are you at with the first Noel? I think you talked about this in the past.
Okay. This is not, I would not be discounting an entire genre or era. I'm not a huge fan of Christmas songs in general, but the first Noel, I just don't like it when people think that they're the first one that's ever thought of that. You know what I mean? Hey, first Noel. Yeah. I'm like, right.
Have you been bowling lately? Holy shit. Step aside, you Shakespeare. There's a new wordsmith in town. Anyway,
regular Fatty Arbuckle over here.
Are you Fred or Rick?
Oh, shit. That's terrible. Sorry, Andrew. Thanks for beeping me. God, Matt.
I'm sorry that happened to you, but Matt. Yeah. Now I know who hurt you. I always ask.
That's terrible. That's terrible.
It's everyone.
So, we all have our burdens to bear. Ben Franklin's was he was wearing a lot of hats. He's the old libertine is known for, you know, being saucy and then allegedly being a serial killer at some parts of history.
More likely a resurrection man, you know what I mean? Yeah, he's doing some experiments in his creepy basement, like you do. But he, like we were saying, though, I mean, the dude had smarts, and he was very forward-thinking and very clever. And Ben, like I was saying, I imagine that he must have been super useful in the war room, right?
Yeah, he was actually he was actually more involved in the direct kind of wet work, you might call it, or covert action, because he was masterminding, strategizing propaganda operations, influence campaigns, and good old-fashioned paramilitary ops against the British. These guys, these three guys we just named, George Washington, acquisition of foreign intel, John Jay, founding father of counterintelligence, Benjamin Franklin, covert action, they had that startup mentality, you know, they were doing other stuff. They were wearing a lot of hats, and they had to wear a lot of hats at this time, because the course of the revolution was determined successfully by this tendency to exercise and this appetite for unorthodox asymmetric strategies. You know, forget Napoleonic warfare, lining people up in rows. First, they didn't have enough resources in terms of firepower and ammunition to do that. And then secondly, they had these, this gave them a tremendous advantage. They had these new agile ways of thinking and the somewhat, I don't want to be unfair, but the somewhat tradition-bound rigor of European enemies couldn't deal with it. They were speaking different languages in war.
Asymmetric just kind of meaning unorthodox, or maybe not traditional, like battlefield, like you said, Ben, like the infantry, the front lines. This is like wars fought on multiple fronts using kind of more secretive means of gathering information about your enemy so that you can kind of head them off at the pass.
Yeah, the way I think about it is exactly what you described, Ben. Those two, if you imagine two armies in revolutionary times looking at each other with their muskets and everything, just aiming, that is symmetric warfare.
Yes.
You've got two identical, you know, forces that are like, I will win. But in this way, you got some flanking folks, right, from one of the sides. You got somebody that sneaks up from behind, and then it just becomes, now it's asymmetrical.
But it also refers to the information gathering of it all, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And there were, you know, of course, there were turncoats on, you know, working for the British. The game goes both ways. A modern example of asymmetric warfare, which we've talked about in the past, is pretty scary. At some point, multiple countries, especially China, looked at the massive U.S. Navy, especially the carriers and the battle groups, and they said, all right, we could spend billions of dollars trying to make a carrier, or we could spend far less money building a missile that can definitely just blow up a carrier. And that's what they went for. That's asymmetry. It's still a huge deal, because it works. And, you know, we could make an entire podcast series about the Revolutionary War and all the crazy espionage occurring then. A lot of people have. There's no shortage of scholarship on the matter. But in general, if in general, in Major General, in Brigadier General, if we're talking about the road to modern intelligence, our story begins with something called the Office of Strategic Services in 1942. Oh man, these guys have popped up in previous episodes as well, right?
That's right. During the Spanish-American War, World War One, and other conflicts, intelligence gathering was considered a bit more ad hoc, I guess, sort of on a case-by-case basis, right? Like sort of as needed per project.
Yeah, like Matt was saying earlier, a lot of this would depend upon person-to-person interactions, right? Finding the right time to pass the letter. Oh, I know you from the salon earlier. The Viscount sends his regards.
Oh, yeah. Well, and also intelligence gathering on a specific location, right? And then folks who are working in that location because it's a strategic target or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, ad hoc is a really good way to put it. I sometimes don't even understand fully what it means, what that means, it's used in a couple of different ways in American English.
Sure. Doesn't it just kind of mean as needed?
Like I think depending on what presents itself.
Yeah. That's how I think about it, but I honestly don't know if that's right.
It's also kind of jazz. Like jazz can there be ad hoc because it's on the spur of the moment. There's a bit of improvisation. There's not ad hoc means that there is not this clearly established ironclad rubric for a procedure. So like CPR,
or an agency that like a centralized, you know, command structure, right? You know what
I mean. Call those guys. We need some intelligence.
Right. Yes.
If only.
Right. So if you, for instance, if you are running down a flight of stairs and you stumble and you catch yourself, you have done some ad hoc parkour, right? So that depending on how you stumble, I don't know. Anyway, this, like we're saying, this was all, again, case by case, right? No big central nervous system of espionage and intelligence gathering. And a lot of times it depended upon individuals who could travel to places. Right, you want to know what's going on in Europe, then you have to talk to Americans who can travel over there.
Well, people who would be able to hide in plain sight as well.
Yes.
Who wouldn't be seen as being out of place.
Think about how tough that is. Somebody who can gain access to an adversary that's high enough to have the intelligence you need and also not be on anyone's radar somehow.
Right.
That's a tough ask.
Well, that's why we love spy movies so much. The stakes are always so damn high. The idea of getting your cover blown, right?
Yeah. And that's why also, I can't remember, did one of you guys at some point recommend the show The Agency?
Well, there's an original French version that is apparently quite good, and there's a new remake with Richard Gere that is also apparently quite good. And I have seen neither, but I've heard great things about both.
Okay. Yeah. This bringing this up because a great deal of like the books in the French series, at least, is all about the maintenance of a cover or a persona and its possible psychological effects over the long term. Right.
Nice,
dude. That's that's why I like The Recruit so much. That show on Netflix. I think it's about a newbie. Getting thrown into that world, you know, with the, like, even his job is a cover. And then you're just like, oh my God, everything just becomes, what is my life? What is this thing?
I'll tell you what else is good while we're recommending spy type shows. It seems like there's been a embarrassment of riches of those lately. Black Doves, which is also, I want to say, a Netflix show with that guy, Ben Whishaw, who's also known as the voice of Paddington in one of my favorite films of all time. It's not CIA, it's British intelligence, but it really does tick a lot of the boxes of what we're talking about. And then, of course, Slow Horses, which we've talked about ad
nauseum. Oh, so good.
We all love that. Yeah.
I read, I think, the first two books, I want to say, as well. Too good. I stopped reading the books because I want to watch the show. That's how I learned about it. And now I'll watch The Recruit, and then I'll watch Black Doves.
Yeah.
And then
spies everywhere.
Really? Yeah, that's sort of their thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just lurking, you know. Yeah,
we're not paranoid, folks.
Nah.
So this idea here, this case-by-case basis, this lack of a centralized authority, nervous system, the analogy we used earlier, this all changed in World War II because at the beginning, the United States got their ass handed to them in Pearl Harbor.
You said ass hand.
Yes. Well, and it's an enormous tragedy.
I'm fired.
Though we're not trying to be, you know, we're being honest. And it may sound glib, it may sound flip, but the reality is there was a successful Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It cost thousands of lives, and war nerds knew there was precedent for this, didn't they?
Yeah, and just really quickly, speaking of war nerds, do check out a two-part series Ben and I did on Ridiculous History that was almost like about a precursor or sort of like a early attempt at the kind of warfare the Japanese would employ during Pearl Harbor.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, at that time it was against the Russian Empire in the turn of the 19th century. This time, it was the attack on the Pearl Harbor naval base that galvanized the U.S. public to support intervention in World War II. It also launched some pretty serious conspiracy theories that continue in the modern day. How much did the U.S. power apparatus know about Pearl Harbor or the likelihood of it occurring in advance? Or did U.S. trade policies push the Japanese Empire toward something where, from their perspective, Pearl Harbor was inevitable?
Yeah, it's a tough question, and it's something we've explored in a bunch of different episodes, like our one on the Project for the New American Century and stuff like that, where if you have an event, and Pearl Harbor is used as an example in that specific episode and that set of circumstances, but if you have an event like that, it will spur both the public mind, right, to want a certain thing, but also it will open up dollars in budgets to create a thing potentially that you want to create. Even, you know, and it doesn't mean that's what happens when there's something like that. It just calls into question the motivations, perhaps, right?
100%. Yeah. Well said there too, because that shows us the system at play, right? The structural reckonings that occur. And to the U.S. establishment at large, in the wake of Pearl Harbor, while the events of World War II are unfolding, everyone in the halls of power at D.C. is looking at each other and saying, holy smokes, if this happens again, it could end the nation. Like, we f***ed up so bad. That's essentially what they're saying. I don't mean to sound like we're characters on Drunk History, which is a great show, check it out, but that's the to your point, Noel, about high stakes, that's the level of the stakes here. And that's why President Roosevelt calls up a very highly decorated veteran of World War One, a man named William J. Donovan.
Billy Donovan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Billy J. Billy J. is kind of a cowboy. He's not the soldier you take home to your parents. Let's put it that way. And he says, all right, Donovan, you're going to head a new organization. It's the first of its kind in the United States. We've been kind of ad hoc for a while. I'm going to call it the Coordinator of Information. And then apparently all the other generals went,
doesn't really have a ring to it.
Yeah.
I know we have to go vague with these things, but that's a little too much.
right. And it was like Secretary of Secrets, and they said no, the abbreviation is SOS. That's gonna screw up everything.
So, no one's already in use.
we need a better acronym.
Secretary of Secrets, though, does sound fun.
Yeah.
I like it when you say it out loud like that. I love the alliteration as well.
Yeah, yeah, agree. It's got a good mouthfeel. Yeah,
Ding, ding.
But it's also maybe a little too fun. You know, how do you introduce yourself at a serious
meeting? Hi, I'm Sass.
I'm shouting into a cat right now, you guys.
Oh, he really did.
He did. It's not a figure of speech.
I've been podcasting from upstairs lately just to, I don't know, have a little change of scenery. And this cat is obsessed with me. Like, oh, my God. It's like, I love this cat. I love Vanessa. I love you. But you're making me go crazy right now. Sorry, guys. Carry on, please.
Oh. Send her my way.
I did. She heard you. She knows.
I nominate you, Vanessa, for our Secretary of Secrets. So, yeah. There we go. It has to be a cat. You know what it I mean? Not to profile,
that's
but
that's perfect.
Very cats would be very well suited for spying. We have an episode either on this show or Ridiculous History about
stuff
animals. Me. That's right. Yeah, it was exactly it's about animals being employed for these very kinds of tasks.
Much like Ben Franklin, cats are always rubbing cheeks with everyone. Indeed.
There we go. Well done. And so coordinator of information, it just doesn't work as the original, as the ongoing name. And so they go with something equally vague, Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. This is made official. It's June 13th, 1942. And here we're going to pause for a word from our sponsors. When we return, we'll tell you why the OSS is a thing that happened.
Who do you know on Ozempic or Semaglutide right now? Probably a ton of people. I know quite a few people as well, because it's everywhere and for good reason.
These groundbreaking GLP-1 medications are changing the weight loss game.
At Future Health, they make accessing this medication simple, safe, and affordable.
Their program connects you with licensed doctors who specialize in GLP-1 treatments, including Ozempic and Semaglutide, so you can get the support you need to reach your weight loss goals.
With Future Health, you'll have access to these trusted weight loss meds, plus ongoing care through their network of over 6,000 doctors and pharmacies nationwide.
And it's so easy to get started. Just go to tryfh.com.
That's tryfh.com.
Find out if weight loss meds are right for you in just 3 minutes at tryfh.com.
Future Health is not a healthcare services provider. Meds are prescribed at provider's discretion. Results may vary. Sponsored by Future Health. We're back. All right. There's no denying it. The Office of Strategic Services, just like intelligence in the Revolutionary War, they are absolutely instrumental in the Allied victory in World War II. It's actually difficult to list all the ways in which the OSS contributed to the war effort, because some of it is still secret. Like, some of it died with people. We will never know the full extent.
We do know, is this the organization that got into code breaking and some of that stuff, or is that specifically, or is that something else?
That would be, you're talking about like Enigma and stuff like that, cryptography. That would be more, oh gosh, what was the guy's name?
Turing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Alan, yeah, that would be
Alan Turing. Alan T.
Yes, the brilliant polymath Alan Turing. OSS not as involved on the cryptography side to the extent that other initiatives were, but they had a lot of weird missions and they had a lot of fun toys. They did behind enemy line stuff, right? They did a lot of training, surveillance, analysis, and what were called operational groups. These operational groups did things like assassination and elimination programs. They did the wet work.
The CIA says often they were used to demoralize the enemy.
Ooh. Right. A lot of psyops. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Compromising newspapers, spreading fake news, that kind of stuff.
100%. And the CIA also would probably argue that the OSS, in its short-lived but very important life, was sort of an incubator for the types of operations and agents that would go on to make up the CIA.
100%. Yeah.
Dude, they did They did things like creating the free tie movement. Yeah. As an operation, and they got a bunch of students involved who had no idea they were working for the OSS, basically.
Tie, right. T-H-I? What are we talking
about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know about this movement.
They dispatched, okay, so they tapped college students who were either Thai American or studying in the U.S. from Thailand, and they found them wherever they could. It was not a big population to choose from what we understand. And then they trained them up, and they shipped them secretly back to Thailand via submarine. Sometimes they walked over the border, and I think they had a few on parachute, right? Which is a pretty crazy gap year for a grad student.
It's crazy because they're there using the university students, the young minds. They're using the potentially capable fighters with young minds that are very malleable to become a resistance force against the force of Japanese military might there in Thailand. It's just, it's creepy smart. And I don't know. It's that yucky feeling of, oh, none of this is actually what I think it is.
Right, yeah. And we see this later reflected in other student movements throughout, especially Latin America. But you don't have to throw a stone far across the globe to find a country or regime that's been touched by something like this, and not always from the Yankees. Sometimes it occurs from the European side, and of course, Soviet forces got very good at this in their own way.
Yeah, they did. It makes you really understand why the U.S. really cracked down on a bunch of student movements, you know, in the 1960s specifically. Oh, yeah. It really makes you understand their paranoia about that because it was their playbook.
That's the thing. Yeah, it's, you know what it's like? This may be a deep reference now, but I bet we're all on the same page. It reminds me of the Key and Peele sketch about the Albanian restaurant and the Macedonian restaurant that are directly across the street from each other. One makes kepapi and one makes cevapi. And they're both, it's super. Have you guys seen this one?
I don't think I've seen this one.
I don't remember it, dude.
Oh, it's legend. It is S tier. I'll send it to you. But it's, without spoiling it too much, the owners of these restaurants are essentially creating the same dish, and they're super pissed that the restaurant across the street is doing it because it's their thing. And that's exactly what happens with student movements in the USSR, made by the USSR, KGB, and made by the US CIA. It's true.
Or shout OSS. Out to Q-Pil.
Or OSS, yes. Ooh, good note, OSS at that time. Yes, because we're not getting to the CIA just yet. The OSS has, as you were saying, Noel, a very short lifespan operationally. They full-time employ about 13,000 people, as in we're not counting the students, we're not counting the assets, we're not counting, you know, the newspaper printers who didn't know who they were taking orders from. The actual facts, employees, 13,000. And they were only, the OSS was only really popping for about, can I say that? All right, fine. Only really popping from about 1942 to 1945, 3 years, very, very short. And the whole time this is happening, our buddy, Billy J. Donovan, is still cooking with gas, man. He's stirring that cauldron of intrigue, and he's saying, ooh, yeah, we're doing, you know, we're doing cool stuff in wartime. And he may have overestimated the effectiveness of some of these projects. And he starts talking to the people in power above him, to the presidents and the presidential staff. And he starts saying, what if we just kind of kept the band going, you know, after the tour that is World War II? What if we had a peacetime version of this to stop wars from ever happening again through trickery? I feel like he paused a second, you know, where he's like, ever happening again through trickery.
Through trickery.
And President Truman, you know, Roosevelt's not president at this point. Now it's President Truman. And he says, you know what, Billy? You make some good points. Mm-hmm.
So that's when later on Truman decided to create the CIA in 1947. The organization pretty much took all of its cues from Donovan, who had earlier pitched the idea of a post-war peacetime spy operation that would continue after World War One. It's more of like a preparedness kind of thing rather than like being in an active conflict.
Well, yeah, and I think you can probably understand why this is such an what felt like a necessary move at the time. You've got major military powers that all rise up during World War II, right, to fight back against a single enemy. But each one of those individual nations that has a massive military now could potentially be that in that frenemy zone, right? That kind of developed while everybody said, hey, there's a real threat over there. We need to eliminate that threat. Now that it's over, we should probably keep our ears and our eyes to our friends that we've just made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pick and choose the parts of the relationships we want to maintain and the avenues of communication. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Bat, because proponents will argue this was a necessary move. And there's validity to that claim because away from the public eye, right, away from all the like shiny, problematic, support the troops propaganda, you know, with Donald Duck and your favorite cartoon characters fighting racist caricatures of Axis powers, away from all that jazz and hubbaloo, Uncle Sam's finest minds have already predicted just what you were describing, Matt, a new conflict on the horizon. The alliance with the Soviets was always fragile. These were real strange bedfellows, the U.S. and the USSR. And it was only a friendship. It was only a working relationship based on the enemy of Axis power. And without that mutual shared enemy, democracy and communism were inevitably going to set on a collision course for nothing less than control of the world. And on the Soviet side, their boffins saw this too, because the nerds are often going to end up being friends with each other outside of political ideologies, because they're the only ones who like are on the level of what the other person is talking about. That's why nuclear technology, it has to be clamped down so hard, because, you know, in certain aspects, it's like there are 50 people who know about it. And they want to hang out with the other 49 people because they're the only ones who like get their dumb puns and stuff like that.
It's important.
Isn't it a little weird that both of these superpowers, here's the thing. I don't know the Soviet view of this from this time. I haven't read enough books or about the history of it. Were the Soviets, I'm trying to understand if, were the Soviets also thinking, oh, we have to become the world's ideology of how, you know, governments are organized and how human beings get their money and how the economics of the world work. We have to be the ones. Or was it just the U.S. thinking they're going to try and take this thing from us?
Well, and I've also always wondered, you guys, like what it is that makes communism and capitalism just so like oil and water, you know, like, I mean, just on paper, just the antithesis to one another. Like, you know, when you think about just what communism is, it doesn't seem that alarmist or doesn't seem that, you know, like counterintuitive, but I guess it is because it's like literally a, you know, making money versus like governing for the people or like having everyone be on an equal playing field. And that just does not jive with capitalism. So therefore it's like a bigger ideological kind of conflict. I'm sorry if I'm oversimplifying, but I think that piggybacks on Matt's question.
It is weird because the oligarch thing can exist in both places.
That's
in
right.
Both ideologies, right? Which is what you imagine is that's who's being served ultimately.
Right. Yeah. So let's unpack that. I think it's worth the time here because these are excellent points. So to the original question, yes, both sides had aspirations to control the world order. In a way, you could argue they were both seeking to make a macrocosmic iteration of their earlier revolutions, the American Revolution, democracy, right? The Communist Revolution, the Soviet Empire. And they did see ideologically, they did see these as mutually exclusive, clashing ideas. And the important point here, the takeaway for all the common John and Ivan Doe's out in the crowd tonight, is that a lot of these decisions were being made by what we would call oligarchs, to your point. In practice, like, communism in theory was often not communism in practice in the Soviet Empire, right? There was a lot of corruption, just the same way that democracy in theory is often not democracy in practice in the history of the United States.
Yeah. It is really strange to me.
Sorry, I know that's cynical, but that's the truth.
No, you're right. Because ultimately it's, well, how will I become wealthy, right? And the minds of the people who are really sitting at the top and deciding that, oh, well, this ideology is the most important thing, so we need to build ships that have the biggest weapons on them and go kill the other guys that also have big ships with weapons because they think different. Sorry, I'm breaking it down to like stupidly general and simplified parts, but it's just,
which I think is key. But I mean, speaking of, you know, the baked in corruption, the difference between, you know, a concept on paper versus how it actually works and operates in the real world, the same could be said of the CIA and some of the sins of the OSS that it kind of inherited, whether you could call it corruption or just sort of circumventing the rule of law. A lot of these things sort of carried over into this new agency, right?
100%.
Yeah, and there is that also that underlying thing of everyone is a potential enemy, you know. Mm-hmm. At least an organization that has to, by its very nature, view everybody as a potential enemy.
Yeah, it's true. It's brutal. I mean, riddle me this. Do you guys know who the most surveilled individuals associated with a lot of these agencies are? Because it's the employees of those agencies.
There you go.
They're also not super trusted, and they can't be because of the nature of their enterprise. I do think it's important here to note that we're not saying people in power during the Cold War were bad faith actors. A lot of them clearly, sincerely believed in the ideology and the ideology they were practicing, the aims they were pursuing. Yet you have to ask why they believed these things. And when you ask that, what you will find is they believed in the thing that was good for them in their social structure. They liked it because they were successful within that milieu, whatever that milieu may be.
Well, yeah, and we can't discount the fact that politicians are often, in a lot of ways, servicing the money, which is the folks who, you know, who can build the bombs and the weapons and the things that are necessary to hold on to power and to maintain those structures. And that hasn't changed. And I don't think that will ever change. And those are the oligarchs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy as well, where it's like, in order to satiate those interests, those economic interests, you almost kind of have to constantly exist in various states of conflict.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
And what do those guys need? Natural resources. If some other empire controls where the resources are, you can't get those resources. You know, you got to pay them for the service of getting those resources. Mm-hmm. So why not just control everything?
I want a word of the day sound cue, word of the evening sound cue right now. Perfect. I trust you, Dylan and Andrew, because Noel, you stumbled on the word of the evening, interest, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, we've done so much for American interest. It's not the same thing as security. It's not the same thing as humanitarian efforts. But it is interesting, you know what I mean? Like, intervening in Libya is interesting. couple of explorations in South and Central America, super interesting.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. Invading Iraq again? Interesting.
Interesting. And what do we mean by that? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsors. Folks, we bet you know at least a handful of people that are taking Ozempic, semaglutide, or other similar medications, and they're doing so for good reason. These are groundbreaking ways for changing quality of life, and future health makes accessing them simple, safe, and affordable.
Yeah, obesity affects roughly 42% of U.S. adults, according to the CDC. And I am actually someone who's struggled with weight loss in the past, and I've had great results from trying some of these GLP-1s in the past myself.
Just take their quick 3-minute survey. From there, if approved by a clinician, you'll get prescribed and get meds delivered to your door within 24 hours.
So don't delay. Find out if weight loss meds are right for you in 3 minutes at tryfh.com. That's tryfh.com. Again, tryfh.com. Future Health is not a healthcare services provider. Meds are prescribed at provider's discretion. Results may vary. Sponsored by Future Health. We've returned. All right, this is the point we're getting at, and I think we're all being very fair with the way we're exploring this, but we nailed something earlier. The proponents have validity to their claims that something like the CIA needs to exist. The critics have validity to their claims that the CIA carried along a lot of the corruption and problematic behavior of the OSS. And that's because this is still Donovan's baby. This is a charismatic leader. He has built a kind of church, really, and he has acolytes, he has followers, he has disciples. Four of those guys end up being directors of the new CIA. They cut their teeth, or made their bones, if you want to use some crime terms, under Donovan directly. They did the wet work. They did the psyops. They did all of that, all the hits, all the slow jazz. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, William Colby, William Casey. And later, when they took control of the CIA, when they were directors, they themselves made decisions that, in hindsight, clearly circumvented the rule of American law and international law in pursuit of kind of a greater good that they thought was very concrete, and that history proves was somewhat of a moving goalpost at times. You know, Bay of Pigs, Cuba, what else? Right?
Iran-Contra was just a thing that happened. You don't need to think about that.
Mm-mm. Pay no attention.
And this is an organization that is meant to protect and champion American democracy and, of course, interest. And so it's interesting that they also attempted to overthrow the Allende government in Chile, which was democratically elected, which was very much on paper the thing the U.S. should support to the fullest and not burn down.
What a weird thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this doesn't count the ways the CIA repeatedly meddled in the African theater, up to and including being associated with assassinations of government leaders. We're not talking about the CIA now. We're talking about the history of this organization. Yes. Yeah. So everybody be cool.
Yeah. Should we talk about the official mission of the CIA, like mm-hmm. what it stated, at least,
yeah,
when it was created? So 1947, July, CIA is born, and its missions are, there are two of them, and then there's a bunch of submissions after that. But the two primary ones are prevent surprise foreign attacks against the United States, right? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Don't let another Pearl Harbor happen. And you do that by gathering intelligence, watching your frenemies. The second is to counter the advance of Soviet communism into Europe and other third world nations, is how they called it.
Yeah.
But yeah, be an ideological stopgap, and then don't let another surprise happen.
Oh, and this gives us insight. Again, we weren't just spinning tails or flipping pancakes when we were saying this was an ideological war. This is very heart and mind and soul. But it's also important to note a common misconception that shows up in the United States all the time, the idea of first, second, and third world countries is inherently BS. It is a phrase from the Cold War. It does not refer to economic development originally, not the way the way it was supposed to be used. Originally, it referred to where people were on this ideological spectrum of democracy v. communism.
Yeah. Are you one, two, or other?
Right, right.
Not yet stomped on, basically.
Not aligned, yeah. And if you are if you are a kid growing up in the United States, then as now, a country purporting to be a democracy and a meritocracy so far, then of course you're going to be taught that first world is the best world.
Of course.
It's democratic, you know.
It's the right one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the he said right. With a weird smile on his face.
Oh, gosh. The beatings will continue until morale improves. Also, look into this is very interesting, folks. Look into when the U.S. public school system decided to make the morning pledge of allegiance mandatory. Hint, it's way more recent than you might assume.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Just gonna leave that there. Just leave that breadcrumb there. That's a tasty one. Pick it up.
There's one other thing that we have to mention here. One of the primary reasons why the CIA was so important as a thing was because there's this term you may have heard, the Iron Dome, like a long time ago, or the Iron Curtain. Yes. The Iron Curtain is probably the most widely used. That's the concept that information doesn't come out of the Soviet Union. There's so many secrets, secret actions, secret motivations, and all these other things that are somewhere behind this curtain that you can't see through. It's iron. Your signals can't even get through it, right? Signals aren't coming out. So you got to find a way to get behind that thing and then get stuff out of it. And that was one of the CIA's main things.
Yes. Yeah. And if you are a longtime listener, you've heard and explored these stories with us in past episodes. If you haven't heard these yet, we encourage you to check them out. And if you are a fan of deep dive books on these sorts of subjects, please also peruse Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II by William Blum and Legacy of Ashes by Tim Weiner. Anyway, the key takeaway, and maybe this is episode one, the key takeaway is this. Descended from an organization founded on an existential need for subterfuge, the CIA has always had an outside-the-box approach to problems, and we are being very diplomatic with that description. Like any good intelligence apparatus, this organization, for better or worse, leaves no stone unturned in its constant effort to protect American interest.
Mm-hmm.
Interest. And, you know, we could say that at times the objectivity of these pursuits fell sway to ideology, right?
Or paranoia.
Or paranoia. You know, there's a lot of, unfortunately, there are examples of this kind of catch-22 Heller-esque reasoning. We had to burn the village to save the village, right? Because otherwise the village would turn communist. And then, you know, when God forbid. It's kind of, it's like a witch hunt, you know? Oh, we killed the person to make sure she wasn't a witch. What happened? Well, she drowned. So, you know, she's not a witch.
Oh, yeah.
Is she a duck, though, is the question.
That's the question posed by such great philosophers as Monty Python, I believe.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Oh, okay.
The best.
I knew it was either them or Plato. That's the issue, though. There's no denying the CIA's historical, asymmetric, unorthodox approach has led the organization to some very strange places. You know, one of the strangest, of course, being MK Ultra. Do we want to talk about MK Ultra for a second?
Absolutely. I mean, we teased it, been talking about some of the crazy ways that the CIA went after Castro, like exposing him to psychedelics, you know, in the hopes that it would make him lose his mind. Well, we also did that to just regular people, like on subway trains in New York City, misting them with LSD. That was only one of the many bizarro operations that went by MK Ultra, also known as Operation Midnight Climax.
Yeah, It started in 1953, way back when. And then it never stopped. No, I'm just joking.
We don't know. That's the thing. Okay, so the American public only knows about, well, the global public only knows about MK Ultra because of a filing mistake. That is a true story. An activist newspaper group broke into the wrong storage facility, and they found papers that had been misfiled that were supposed to be destroyed in entirety. So to this evening in 2025, no one knows all of what MK Ultra was over, or what it encapsulated, encompassed, because it is a group umbrella term for a lot of other projects like Operation Midnight Climax, which you can hear a fantastic podcast on, hosted by none other than Mr. Noel Brown. And Noel,
oh man, thanks. You know, that was super fun to be a part of, and it really does tell the whole story in a really interesting and well sound designed kind of narrative way. And speaking of narrative, Ben, another project that, you know, talks about this type of thing is The Control Group, written by Brett Wood and EP'd by you, Ben Bolin, which is a really great piece about kind of psychedelic experimentation, you know, in a government capacity.
Dude, that's an intense one. It was one of my favorite podcasts for a long time because it was fictional, but it was based so much on actual stuff.
Big time.
Brett Wood's a beast, yeah, and an extraordinarily humble guy. That also was sound designed and EP'd by our brother in arms, Paul Mission Control Deccant. So credit where it's due.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, yeah, as far as we know, the MK Ultra program did not create a Manchurian candidate. As far as we know, because again, most of the conclusions and paperwork and documentation was destroyed. And a lot of the researchers, through one means or another, were prevented from ever going public. And at this point, as you said, Matt, beginning in the 50s, at this point, a lot of the original Avengers or Justice League crew of mad science here, they're long dead.
Oh, yeah. But you know what didn't die?
The crux. The funk? Oh.
Never.
Never let the funk die.
Well, another thing. So we talked about how MK Ultra, we only know about because of those unshredded documents that were supposed to die and go away forever. We only know about the stuff we're going to be talking about in part two of this series because of another series of documents that didn't get shredded properly and were just sitting around in a place where they weren't supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And now we know.
And I'm going to tell you, honestly, guys, this is something that the espionage movies and the fiction in the film, the novels and so on, is what they always miss. You know what spies are really afraid of, and spy masters more so than even a bullet? It's paperwork. It's a paper trail. It's documentation. Yeah. It's indisputable proof, right? So this stuff, it may sound, you know, like a funny Benny Hill sketch. Oh, we found the papers that show the secret operations. But that's terrifying to the MIs of the world. Like MIs.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they thrive on plausible deniability or just straight up deniability. It's sort of the whole point is not to be able to be connected with any of these things.
Yeah, especially names, like actual names of human beings that are involved. My God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of names, at the center of this web of MK Ultra, there is a weaving spider, a whispering voice, a Varys of sorts, a singular, fascinating, and troubling man, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, who will play a major role in our later explorations. amid all these chaotic scramblings for an edge, any advantage over enemies, seditionist movements, even allies, the CIA explored surprising conspiratorial partnerships with the most unlikely groups and individuals. This series, question, how far did this go? Did the CIA actually hire magicians? That's right. This is going to be a two-part episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please join us, fellow conspiracy realists, for chapter two of the CIA Hired Magicians. We left you with a cliffhanger because there was a lot of context we had to get to, a lot of explorations together in the dark. So while you're waiting in the interim, if you're wondering, hey, I'm already on the internet, what am I going to do now? Just keep waiting for chapter two. Never fear. You can join the show yourself. Reach out to us. You can find us on email, via telephone, and the internets.
Indeed. You can find us at the handle Conspiracy Stuff, where we exist on Facebook with our Facebook group, Here's Where It Gets Crazy, on YouTube, where we have video content for you to enjoy, as well as on X, FKA Twitter, on Instagram and TikTok. We are Conspiracy Stuff Show.
If you want to give us a call, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Tell us your espionage stories, especially if you've been involved with them. When you call in, you've got 3 minutes. Give yourself a cool nickname and let us know in the message whether or not we can use your name and message on the air. If you've got more to say than can fit in a voicemail, why not instead send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
the entities that read every single piece of correspondence we receive. And don't feel like the email has to be your last resort. Even if you want to just send us a fun one-liner, a haiku, a secret code word, right? Something to update us on Operation Rutabaga. We're all about it. Give us the links. Give us the photographs. Write your story. No word limit. We can all see it. We can all respond. And we would love for you to join us out here in the dark. Conspiracy at iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Who do you know on Ozempic or Semaglutide right now? Probably a ton of people. I know quite a few people as well, because it's everywhere, and for good reason.
These groundbreaking GLP-1 medications are changing the weight loss game.
At Future Health, they make accessing this medication simple, safe, and affordable.
Their program connects you with licensed doctors who specialize in GLP-1 treatments, including Ozempic and Semaglutide, so you can get the support you need to reach your weight loss goals.
With Future Health, you'll have access to these trusted weight loss meds, plus ongoing care through their network of over 6,000 doctors and pharmacies nationwide.
And it's so easy to get started. Just go to tryfh.com.
That's tryfh.com.
Find out if weight loss meds are right for you in just 3 minutes at tryfh.com.
Future Health is not a healthcare services provider. Meds are prescribed at provider's discretion. Results may vary. Sponsored by Future Health.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
With the Amex Gold Card, you can run your errands and grab a pick-me-up from Dunkin' on Amex. Earn up to $7 in monthly statement credits when you pay with the Gold Card at Dunkin'. Enrollment required. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/us/explore-gold.
Looking to transform your business through better HR and payroll? Meet Paycor, the powerhouse solution that empowers leaders to drive results. From recruiting and development to payroll and analytics, Paycor connects you with the people, data, and expertise you need to succeed. Their innovative platform helps you make smarter decisions about your most valuable asset, your people. Ready to become a better leader? Visit paycor.com/leaders to learn more. That's paycor.com/leaders.